You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. High school sports statewide completed their first full season in nearly 2 years. But as students head back to courts and fields, the circumstances continue to change. Back in 2020, the pandemic put a stop to almost all activities, including sports. In February of last year, Governor Gavin Newsom loosened restrictions on organized youth sports, allowing students across the majority of the state to once again take up practices and games. Well, the third year of the pandemic brings about more challenges that the California Interscholastic Federation, or CIF, is working to adapt to due to the particularly contagious Omicron variant. The CIF section, representing the SAC San Joaquin section, is the second largest in the state, reaching nearly 250,000 students from Sacramento through the Central Valley. Joining us now is the Assistant Commissioner of the CIF SAC San Joaquin section, Will DeBoard. Will, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicky. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. Before we get to current challenges and the current situation, let's just take a brief look back. I mean, you just completed the first full season of high school sports in almost 2 years. How did the fall season go?
Fall season actually went pretty well. Nice thing about the fall is almost all those sports are outdoor sports. And we the CIF, we're a rules-following organization. And whatever the state of California public health tells us to do, we're going to do. And indoor sports, there was girls volleyball. They were required to wear masks for the entire season, which they did. But the outdoor sports, basically, that was allowed to happen. And it pretty much did. Football, water polo, cross country. People have been running anyway during the pandemic. It seems like there's been more running, an outbreak of running and an outbreak of golf. And we had girls golf. And yeah, we did have some postponements. And certainly there were kids who got ill, who didn't play, maybe didn't play games. But overall, it was a good step to kind of getting back to normal, or the new normal, I guess.
Were there any hiccups or learning lessons from last fall?
I think a lot of the learning lessons actually came from the year before, when pandemic was in full. Everybody had a lot of restrictions, and we certainly saw it at the school level. Athletic directors, we did end up having a very short season, no playoffs or anything like that, but just getting out there and getting active. And athletic directors in schools, and really us as well, we all learned that you needed to be fast on your feet. And if somebody couldn't play, you needed to get on the horn or get on social media real quick and find an opponent, because you had a team ready to play, and let's find somebody to play them. And that worked out pretty well. I think last year was a good learning experience for what we went through in the fall, and certainly what we're going through right now.
Yeah, well, let's get to now. I mean, we've been talking with school officials about really the evolving challenges due to the Omicron variant, more people testing positive, and that ultimately impacts attendance for adults and students. I mean, Sac City Unified alone is down 20% of school staff in its first week. How is this trickling down to athletics?
It's definitely trickling down to athletics. We obviously we feel education-based athletics is a big part of your school life, and we certainly get a lot of calls, and a lot of people are driven to get their kids back and active, not just learning in the classroom, which is obviously primary and what most important, but you learn a lot on the field of play as well. And this winter, what we're seeing, these are indoor sports. This is wrestling, competitive cheer, basketball. We do play soccer in the winter, and that's been going on fairly okay. But under our guidelines, kids need to test once a week. And what our schools have definitely discovered, and what we've definitely discovered, is there are a lot of kids who are asymptomatic, who are testing positive, not being able to play. We're seeing a lot of cancellations. We're currently in the middle of, I'm assuming the fallout from the holiday season, where a lot of people have been getting in touch, and a lot of people have been in touch with people maybe they haven't been in touch with in a while, and we're certainly seeing a lot of cancellations. We're heading right into our postseason. It seems like the winter really started in November for our schools. We got a lot of games in. We're getting a lot of games in December. But it's definitely ramping up. And when you have a positive test, when a kid has a positive test, they're out for 5 days minimum, until they test negative again. And again, these are CDC and CDPH guidelines that we're following, that our schools are following. And yeah, we're going to see what happens. In about a month, we start with our wrestling, followed shortly by soccer and basketball championships. Our winter competitive sport invitational was supposed to happen this Saturday. We were getting a lot of cancellations there, so we postponed it to February 5th, and we're gonna and honestly, it's our turn to really kind of be fast on our feet. Our athletic directors, they're the ones in the front lines that are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis, and it is our turn to be the ones fast on our feet and make adjustments. And the nice thing as well is our coaches, our schools, our teams, they've been fairly flexible. They understand what's going on, and they understand that, what they've been trying to do is, again, get back to a little sense of normalcy. And we're trying to do the same, hopefully, although it doesn't feel very normal right now,
Yeah.
that's for sure.
Yeah, it's continuing to get a lesson in being malleable. I actually saw that post of a postponement of the competitive cheer invitational that's going to be postponed to February due to too many illnesses from COVID. I guess as a whole, how are you navigating tracking or gauging the risk and ultimately making these decisions?
I'm a high school sports administrator. I definitely didn't have to go to school nearly as long as doctors did. We follow doctors and healthcare professionals, and what they tell us that we're able to do, that's what we do. And again, our schools, our athletes, our coaches, our athletic directors, they absolutely want to get it back out there. We do too, but we want to do it safely. And we're following what the experts are telling us to do. And so far, again, fall went fairly well. I think as we move out of winter and into spring, and we're back into a lot of outdoor sports, I don't think that's going to be a problem. But certainly where we're testing right now with these indoor sports, yeah, it's been a challenge, that's for sure. It's been a challenge for our schools.
Yeah, that definitely changes the dynamic in a reality or an environment where adjustments have just become a norm. Last week, CIF statewide announced that high schoolers can play sports games on Sundays. What brought about the change, and has your section taken advantage of this new rule?
Yeah, the CIF state office also did that in the fall. In the fall, we had different challenges. We had COVID challenges, although it wasn't nearly as prevalent as I think it is right now. But also, we had air quality issue challenges
Wildfires.
as well. And we allowed people to play on Sundays. And at least one football game was played on Sunday. They kind of said it's our football before the NFL, and it was Mariposa and Delhi. Schools in Mariposa County and Merced County did play. As the cancellations and postponements have kind of ramped up, we've allowed our schools to do the same. Kids want to be active. They want to be out there and doing things. And when games aren't being played, and when you aren't able to practice because you have a positive test, and most of the time these kids are asymptomatic, you want to allow them to be out there and do things if you can. And if that means being able to play on Sundays, and they're gonna then if they wish, they can play on Sundays. We certainly aren't mandating that you have to play on Sundays or really any day of the week whatsoever. But we give them the option. Again, this comes back to being flexible.
Right, being nimble. When talking about schools or learning about school positivity cases, not only for students, but also staff, I mean, what happens with officials? I mean, how is this going to ultimately impact games if potentially there's not enough officials so games can actually be held?
It's been honestly kind of our biggest challenge is officials. Our officials, for whatever reason, they skew a little older as it is. They've been a little more cautious when it comes to COVID, because senior citizens are being hit by this disease a lot harder. We didn't have a lot of officials come back last year, and they still have kind of stayed away. And we're we were able to get through football. We were able to get through water polo and volleyball, and it went fairly well. Basketball has definitely been a challenge, and there have been times where we haven't had enough officials. Normally, I think in the northern half of our section, we normally have a field of about 300 officials, 300 to 320 officials, and I think we're right around 190. So it's a big drop off. And what we're seeing, we're not seeing three-man crews in basketball. We're seeing two-man crews, and sometimes freshman games, because we have three different levels of basketball: freshman, JV, and varsity. The varsity and the JV games, they're going to get officials, and the freshman games may not get officials from our group, the NCAA. They may get rec league officials. They may pick up each team may provide a coach to officiate those freshman games, because really what you're looking at is you're looking at kids being out there, being active, and developing for those JV and varsity seasons.
Is ultimately, are you preparing for cases to continue to increase? Because we haven't really, I mean, according to public health officials, we haven't really spiked yet.
No, we haven't. That's for it. It doesn't seem that way. You're exactly right there, and that's what we're hearing as well. And if it means we need to push things back a little bit, we're ready, willing, and able to push our postseason back to allow people to get a full regular season in. And it means we normally have days off in between rounds of playoffs. You're able to play basketball. Unlike football, you're able to play basketball, soccer, even wrestling matches. You have them on back-to-back dates, and sometimes you even have multiple games in a day. Again, it's tough to tell what things are going to look like. You look at other countries where this Omicron variant has shown up, and it's shown up and it's hit pretty hard, and it's gone away somewhat fast, and I knock on wood as I say that, but who knows what's going to happen here? Nobody knows, and you just have to take it on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah. I'm curious with obviously the indoor sports, there's masking, correct? But how isn't that challenging for sports like wrestling?
So yes and no. What the current guidelines say is that you are supposed to mask in these sports. However, you can also, in lieu of wearing a mask for sports like basketball, which is a pretty aerobic sport, or wrestling, or even competitive cheer, they're allowing testing on a weekly basis. So schools are testing. They're testing their athletes at minimum on a weekly basis. Some of our schools are even doing it on twice weekly basis. And as kids test positive, contact tracing, and those kids are out. A big difference between a year ago and now: if a team had somebody test positive a year ago, that team was generally out. They didn't field a skeleton crew and continue playing or anything like that. And it seems like, as we've learned a little bit more, if you've not been in touch with other people who have been positive, you're still able to play, and they have those tests in hand. So yeah.
Schools have become a forum for a variety of viewpoints and debates about, you know, the best way to move forward. And school sports are not exempt from that. What are you hearing from parents and even coaches about the rules that are currently in place? You know, even
Well,
masking.
it's kind of interesting. We get the full spectrum, as I imagine everybody in any sort of regulatory capacity does. We have people saying, "What are you doing? Why are schools in session? And why are you having sports?" And we have quite a few other people, I would say the majority, are saying we need to get these kids back out there and being active. Certainly see both sides, and it's a tough one to navigate. We, as the CIF, we deal in high school sports, and again, we're going to follow what the state public health department tells us to do, and what our county public health officials tell us to do. Sac Joaquin section, we're kind of an interesting situation, because we have 16 different counties where we deal with high schools, and Merced County may say something completely different than what Yolo County is saying. So we have to navigate not only from a state side of things, but also each county. And some schools and some counties are allowing a little more leeway, allow kids to be out there, get out there, and do a little bit more, while others are a little more strict.
Before we let you go, what has the pandemic taught you about the importance of high school sports?
I think it's what it's taught me is that yes, high school sports are important, but I think honestly, I really think we need to get through this, and It's tough to tell exactly what has been correct. I know a year ago it was tough on kids, it was tough on teachers and schools to not be doing anything. And I think we do need to get back. I think we do need to get back to normal, but I know this next month, a month and a half, is going to be pretty interesting for us. And I know the last month has been pretty interesting for a lot of our winter sports. This has definitely been our biggest challenge. And if nothing else, I learned that I have a lot less hair than I did a couple of years ago, that's for sure.
You and a lot of us are going gray.
Thank you
Well, thank you.
very much, Vicky.
Will DeBoard is the Assistant Commissioner of the CIF San Joaquin Section. Up next, visualizing California's wildfire history through an interactive map going back over a century. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Last August, as the Caldor Fire in El Dorado and Alpine counties was making its march towards the city of South Lake Tahoe, Tom Porter, the now former CAL FIRE chief, proclaimed during a press conference that, quote, "Every acre can and will burn in California one day. Just make sure to be ready when it does." Pretty ominous words, but if you look at the history of wildfires in California, it is striking to see just how much of California has already burned. From small fires to some of the more recent megafires like the Caldor, Dixie, or Camp Fires, just to name a few, the map of California seems like at some point or another, much of the state has seen some scale of fire activity. And it's really interesting to see which pockets and slivers of California have been unharmed by fire. So, what can a historical map of California wildfires teach us about the state, our topography, fire management, and what the future may hold? Joining us today to discuss a brand new interactive California wildfire history map on capradio.org are CAP Radio's data reporter Emily Zentner and UC Merced fire science professor Crystal Colden. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, Emily, let's start with you. I mean, you really kind of took on this undertaking, shouldered it. So let's start with the project. Explain what it is and why you decided to tackle it and really why it's important.
Yeah, so we first published our historical map of California wildfires in January of 2019. And this is an expanded and updated version of that that includes some new features that we're really excited about. So the map shows recorded California wildfires, which is an important distinction because CAL FIRE does not have a record of every fire that's happened, going back to the 1860s. And so you can explore that by decade. And from the years 1970 on, where there's some more complete data, you can also explore the fires by season. And I've lived in Northern California for most of my life. And, you know, I've been covering fires for years, like all of us at CAP Radio have. And so I've watched and seen fire seasons intensifying over the last few years. And as a journalist and as a data journalist, I personally really wanted to see that in a historical context. And we're at this point where, you know, we can do some things to improve the fire situation in California, but I think we're also at a point where we need to come to terms with some of these changes and learn how we're going to live with them. And that's, you know, a process of grieving and adapting. And I think understanding what these changes have looked like over time can help us with that.
Yeah. I mean, really just kind of being aware of our blind spots and maybe relooking and reevaluating things. But when you're talking about data, that can be overwhelming. It can be messy. So how did you acquire all of that fire data and sort through it?
Yeah. So the data we use is actually publicly available on Cal Fire's website. A couple of years ago when I first wanted to do this, I just mentioned that, and my boss, Chris Hagen, was like, I'm pretty sure that's just on Cal Fire's website to download. So, you know, we just downloaded that from there. And then we worked with the person who manages that data for Cal Fire, Dave Passavoy, and he helped us understand any issues with it and make sure that we were describing the data and using it accurately.
Right. Given that you've lived in Northern California most of your life and you have covered wildfires for several years, what surprised you when digging through the history of wildfires in California?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that surprised me a little bit is I grew up in the mountains in Placer County, and I never had to evacuate my whole childhood. Like, you know, I don't have this memory of growing up there and having fire be a part of my life. So it was interesting to see fires like right near where I grew up and just realize that it maybe was not as big of a deal as a fire is today because they were smaller, they were more, you know, more controllable. And when I first started using this data 2 years ago, I was really surprised also to see areas that hadn't burned at all, like a lot of the Central Valley, a lot of the desert in Southern California, where there's no fires, and then so many areas with so many fires over the years. And it was interesting to look at some of those areas, like the area around the campfire, and see where they had burned over and over and over again, and thinking about, like, this is an area that just is going to keep burning. We clearly have not found a way to you know, prevent here yet. And I knew 2020 would be shocking because I was covering the 2020 fire season, but I couldn't believe when I switched from looking at a whole decade of data in the 2010s to looking at just 2020 and just seeing how massive 2020's fires were.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at that multiple times. I mean, when you go back to the 70s, the 80s, obviously the 90s and 2000s, and then you go to 2020s, it's just, it's like it's a different, it's a different state in terms of the magnitude of wildfires. Well, the data that you actually have goes back to the 1800s, 1868, and then it's separated into decades from 1970 through 2019 and the year 2020 on its own. Can you talk about how you kind of figured out how to separate the data over really what's more than a century?
Yeah, when we decided to filter out the fires in the map by the season that they started in, we started looking at the data and saying, okay, when does the start date data get a little bit more spotty? And that was, you know, kind of in the 1960s. So looking at, you know, okay, fires from 1969 back, the data is a little bit less complete. We decided to separate that out on its own so that you can still see those historic fires because we felt like that was interesting, but not do that seasonal analysis on them because the data was less complete. And then separating 1970 to 2019 into decades really came down to fires can fluctuate a lot, you know, from year to year with weather, how much snow or rain there was in that particular year, you know, what lightning storms were like that year. So it can be hard to look from year to year and see these changes, but we felt like by grouping them by decade, you can see that change over time a little bit better. And 2020 is separate because we're just starting the 2020s. So we didn't feel like we had enough data quite yet to compare that to the rest of the decade since we just have the 1 year.
Yeah. Going back to how you compiled all this data, I mean, you said it was publicly available on Cal Fire's website, but I think you're being modest with when it comes to the amount of work that it takes to actually come up with this interactive wildfire map, the finished product. What kind of obstacles or challenges did you come across when doing the research for this project?
So this is a huge data set. There's more than 20,000 fires in it, and it's a data set that's managed by a human being. So there are a lot of errors in it. There are some typos. There's some years that are mistyped. And those are things that when you're building an interactive like this are a problem because if something has the wrong year, I'm using the year to determine the decade, then, you know, that creates kind of a cascade of problems. So it took me probably a few weeks to go through pretty much all the lines of the data in one way or another and make sure that those mistakes weren't there. And there were also just a lot of terminology pieces and processes behind this data that we needed to understand. And so that came down to talking to our source at Cal Fire who manages the data set and saying, you know, what does this actually mean? And also, you know, talking to people like Crystal and finding out one thing that Crystal explained to us was we didn't realize that there had been changes over time in the policy around when you would consider a fire contained. So we were originally looking at using that containment date for some analysis. And after talking to Crystal, realized that that was not really a valid way to go through things. So that, you know, that just learning about the data and about how these things are done was totally key to making sure that we were doing this accurately.
Well, Crystal, let's bring you in. You're a fire science expert and professor at UC Merced, a pyrogeographer, and you joined us last fall in September during the Caldor fire. And we talked about why wildfires are getting larger, lasting longer, and becoming more destructive. There is a maze of reasons we can talk about. But with that lens, what struck you about being able to visualize this in an interactive map?
Yeah, there's quite a few things that we talk about all the time as fire scientists, trends that we're seeing or patterns that we see that come through so clearly in this visualization. And I was thrilled when Emily contacted me about this update because I, you know, even though I have all these data and can make maps, I use this visualization constantly with my students and with members of the public when I'm talking about things because it's so powerful to see this across a state that most of us know particularly well, depending on where we live, right? And the things that become really clear in the way that these data are visualized are things like, oh, right, we are seeing that fire burns almost everywhere in the state, like Emily said, right? And this is something we talk about it as fire scientists, just because you haven't seen fire in a place for several decades doesn't mean that it is not a natural process in that place that we've basically just excluded for years. And really the places in the state where we don't have fire historically are the places that there simply isn't any vegetation or very much vegetation. So the deserts don't carry fire very well because they just don't have enough vegetation. It's always really dry and hot there, but they just don't have enough fuel to burn, right? And the Central Valley is agriculture. So it's not a surprise to see this giant donut hole elongated in the middle of the state, right? Because we've got mostly agriculture in the Central Valley, which is really different than it looked like pre-settlement. So, you know, that's the thing that comes through really clearly when you initially look at this.
I mean, this map really allows us to take a hard and detailed look at wildfires historically. But what does this also tell us about the future of wildfires in California?
Yeah, so it shows us where fires are going, right? Because there's a couple things that jump out that I talk about all the time as a scientist, and that it is so helpful to be able to just show people with this visualization. One is that we are actually getting fewer fires, but they're much, much bigger. And you can see this so clearly in looking at these fires across the decades where, you know, there's always been a really high number of fires, but mostly much smaller. And so these recent mega fires, right? And of course, in 2020, we had the largest wildfire ever in California, the August complex. The Dixie Fire made a run at that number this year. And we have all of these really large wildfires in recent years that we don't have in the historical record. So these fires are burning over much longer periods. They're much more difficult to control, right? Because Cal Fire and the Forest Service have every tool that they can possibly get their hands on, and they still can't control these fires, right? And that is such a good indicator of how climate change is altering fire behavior. The other thing that climate change is doing is that it's changing our seasonality, because what I love about what Emily and her colleagues did in breaking this out by seasons is that we actually see, oh, right, we used to mostly have summer fires, right? And that's something that Californians understand, that summer is fire season, right? But what we have begun to see, and what our recent science is also demonstrating, is that we're getting more fires in the fall, and some of our really large and most destructive fires, like the Camp Fire
and the Thomas Fire,
have happened, and the Thomas Fire and the Wine Country fires in 2017. These are all fires that are happening much later in the year than historically, right? And that is something that our science is showing in terms of the drying out of fuels, and that they are staying dry much later into the year and into fall, because we're just not getting the precipitation that we historically did, right, in September and October. So that trend is really clear when you just sort of slide back and forth and through the decades on this map.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're joined by CAP Radio data reporter Emily Zentner and a professor of fire science at UC Merced, Crystal Colden, discussing CAP Radio's interactive California wildfire history map and really how the state's fires have changed over time. Let's talk about forest management, because the phrase wildfire prevention is getting challenged. I mean, there's decades of fire suppression, which is contributing to mega fires that we're living through, coupled with climate change. But after watching two wildfires crest over the Sierra for the first time in state history, the Dixie and the Caldor fire, we're in a new year. An upcoming wildfire season is just months away. Crystal, in your view, where has California fallen short? And ultimately, is it to the degree where we just all need to become accustomed to living with these mega fires for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, as a fire scientist, we talk a lot about the need to live with fire. And I think the key is that we actually have a lot of evidence and a lot of data and a lot of knowledge from our indigenous fire practitioners in the state that says, you know, we're going to have to live with fire. But here's the thing. We don't have to live with mega fires, right? So there's a big difference between having a million really small fires and one giant million acre fire, right? It's just a huge difference for people that are living with the smoke that that fire produces, that get evacuated from their homes for weeks on end. And really, when we have a million acre fire, it burns much more intensely than a million small fires do, right? And so what I think the state is really recognizing, and this is clear in the recent budgets that have come out, and the one that was just announced this week, right? The governor and the state are recognizing we've got to do more prescribed burning. We've got to change how we're managing these landscapes so that we're able to do a lot more prescribed burning. We're able to keep fires out of communities and allow them to burn naturally up in the more remote backcountry areas like they have always done for millennia. And if we're able to do that, then yes, we will be living with fire, right? But we won't be living with this, you know, 3-month window where there are giant mega fires pouring smoke into every corner of the state, right? Instead, we're living with fire that is spread out across the state over the course of the entire year. I live in the foothills up in the Sierra, and we are looking at an absolutely gorgeous burn window over the next couple of weeks. And we'll be, you know, trying to do a fair amount of burning up here in a time when it's not a threat, in a time when the smoke will actually move out pretty quickly because it's the winter, right? And that's the kind of fire we can live with, right? And that's the type of fire that Californians need to think about moving forward is, okay, we're going to have to live with this because we love our natural environment, right? But it's a very flammable natural environment. So how do we have it burn in such a way that it's controlled, that it's not threatening our homes and communities, and that the smoke is moving out pretty quickly? And the answer is, it's a really complex set of management activities, and it's also a fair amount of prescribed fire.
When actually taking into mind, which is so important, people that are actually living in these wildfire areas. We just learned last week that one of PG&E's power lines triggered the Dixie fire, you know, over a million acres, destroying over 1,300 homes. Not the first time and not the only utility company. How can these juggernaut utility companies like PG&E safely coexist with the wildfire conditions and circumstances we're living with? Or is in the foreseeable future, are power safety shutoffs and this a goal of burying power lines? Is that actually realistic or reasonable?
Yeah, so PG&E has a monumental task because they have so many miles of power lines, and their recently announced initiative last year of burying 10,000 miles of power lines it's a drop in the bucket compared to what they have through areas that are flammable, right? And so really the challenge for all utilities is to figure out how to modernize their risk management protocols and figure out, okay, when is it really the only viable solution to go through public safety power shutoffs? Those have their own set of risks for people that really depend on continuous energy, and what are the things that they can do and need to do to update their technology, right? And one of the things that we've seen in Southern California is that both San Diego Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison have really made huge strides in developing their own in-house risk management and their own forecasting of really severe fire conditions in-house. And that is helping them make much better decisions about when they really actually have to turn the power off and also where they need to prioritize burying their lines, because it is so expensive and that gets passed on immediately to us, the consumers. For PG&E, they cover a much larger area of the state and it's a monumental task. But that is the only way to move forward, is to update that, because right now that network is over a century old and it's really not reflecting the risk levels that we're seeing today with the amount of fuels on the landscape and what climate change is doing to those fuels to increase their flammability.
Hmm. Emily, bringing you back in, what will you and the digital team keep updating with the maps, and ultimately how will this project evolve? Because it's been about 3 years now, right? You started it in 2019.
Yeah, this was actually one of the first projects I think I worked on after starting at Cap Radio, and it's evolved over time. And I think the first big change that's coming is that the 2021 wildfire data from CAL FIRE will become available this spring, and we'll be adding that. And I'm personally really interested and excited to see what that looks like and to learn from that. And one of the big changes with this versus the version of this we first published in 2019 is we had the digital products team here at Cap Radio collaborating with us on this project. And our web developer, Liz Anderson, and I worked hand in hand on this. And we worked with our UX designer, Veronica Nagy, and really improved the functionality of this map to allow people to explore more. And we're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep looking at how we can make this more usable for people and looking at other data that would be useful to display, other filters that would be useful for people so that, people can see more about what's changing with fires. We would eventually love to be able to show fires by cause, which was not possible with the current data that we have. So we're definitely looking at what we can add, looking at what other data would be good to explore, and looking at what other filters people would like to see to be able to learn about this.
Well, thank you so much, Emily, for all your hard work. And thank you, Professor Colden, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that is Cap Radio data reporter Emily Zentner and professor of fire science at UC Merced, Crystal Colden. Still ahead, the historical context surrounding the January 6th insurrection and how it can shape the midterm elections. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A year after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Americans are still deeply divided over what they believed happened on January 6th. But January 6th will be remembered as one of the most infamous days in the nation's history. Although a year is really barely a drop in the bucket of ocean in the ocean of time, historians are already discussing how January 6th compares to other watershed moments in American history, and really what it could mean for the future of our country. One of these discussions is happening later today, and it's open to the public. Four UC Davis history professors are hosting an online forum exploring the historical context and political consequences of the insurrection. One of those professors is Professor Catherine Olmsted, and she joins us now. Professor Olmsted, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first off, this is taking place later this afternoon. Tell us about this online forum and what you and your colleagues hope to achieve with this discussion.
So this is a forum that's put out by the Davis Humanities Institute. So anybody interested in joining can go to the Davis Humanities Institute webpage, dhi.ucdavis.edu, to register for the event and get a Zoom link. There are four of us. We're all history professors. And so we want to talk about January 6th in historical context, historical perspective. So one of my colleagues, Justin Leroy, will talk about African-American history. He's a specialist in African-American history, and he's going to look at the diverging experiences of arrested Capitol insurrectionists and Black Lives Matter protesters and how different forms of protests were punished differently. Then my colleague David Beal is a specialist in Jewish history, and he's going to look at whether historical analogies are useful for current political events, specifically looking at the example of the fall of the Weimar Republic and the rise of the Nazi regime. And then my colleague Greg Downs is a specialist in Civil War and Reconstruction history. And he's going to ask the question, what is the history of coups and election violence in the era of the Civil War and Reconstruction? Tell us about what happened a year ago. And then I'm a specialist in conspiracy theories in U.S. history in the 20th and 21st centuries. So I'm going to talk about the role that conspiracy theories played in the insurrection.
That is a lot to go through. On the event website, January 6th is described as a day without historical precedent in U.S. history. What made January 6th so unprecedented from a historical perspective?
Well, never before had you had a mob that surged into the Capitol with the goal of potentially harming members of Congress and the vice president in order to stop the counting of electoral votes and the formal certification of the election. It was, close to a coup, and this had never happened before in the United States.
A week after January 6th in 2021, you and your colleagues hosted an online town hall for the campus to talk about what happened. Why did you feel compelled to do so? And also, what was the response from your community? How do you reflect on that time, really, a year later?
Well, we had an online town hall because a lot of our students, we were already in session at UC Davis then because we're on the quarter system. A lot of our students were asking questions. And so we decided, well, we'll put on an event. And initially it was for the history club for students. But when they then put out the poster, it turned out there was a tremendous amount of interest, and more than 200 people showed up to the online event. It was remote because of the pandemic, but it was there was a lot of response. And so there were six of us who gave 5-minute presentations, and then we answered questions. And there were students and faculty and staff and community members. And mostly people were just really searching for answers, wanting to understand how this possibly could have happened and whether they needed to worry about it happening again.
Yeah. Last Thursday was the one you're marking, January 6th. There were a lot of events and discussions and really coverage surrounding that day, the days leading up and the days following. How have conversations and really the interest evolved within the UC Davis community? And what strikes you about January 6th a year later and listening to what people are talking about?
Well, as a historian, of course, I'm always interested in the discovery of new evidence that we didn't necessarily know at the time. So I'm following the January 6th committee very closely. And I think that we're continuing to learn so much. We learned, for example, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the CIA were worried for months that there could be a coup. It was something that we didn't know at the time. There's lots of evidence about President Trump's advisors and family members being desperate to try to get a hold of him, to have him tell the mob to stand down. All of this new information is coming out, and it's really going to help us understand the narrative of what happened. But perhaps more important for the country is to understand what happened so that we can prevent something like this from happening again.
Given that you specialize in conspiracy theories and in the United States, you know, going back to the 20th and 21st century, what role do you think that these played in leading up to the insurrection, and which ones are still with us and continuing to shape and really perpetuating falsehoods?
Well, all of the people who showed up in that mob and who breached the Capitol were motivated by a conspiracy theory, by what we call the big lie, that despite Joe Biden's margin of more than 7 million votes and a decisive edge in the Electoral College, that he had not won legitimately, that the election had been rigged or stolen. And so they believed that it was their patriotic duty to stop him from being certified as president. And conspiracy theories are not new in American history. Of course, we have had conspiracy theories ever since the first European colonists set foot on American shores. And there have been conspiracy theories about Catholics and Jews and Mormons and arms manufacturers and big pharma, everything. But what's new about conspiracy theories today is, first of all, of course, they can be spread much more easily with the internet over the last 25 years, but especially social media lately, where there's no gatekeepers to stop misinformation from spreading. But perhaps even more significant than that, there are now a lot of political leaders who are spreading or at least tolerating these conspiracy theories, which is new in American history. And these conspiracy theories have the potential to lead to violence as they did on January 6th, mm-hmm. that they're not just intellectual concerns by people who say, you know, I really think the CIA killed JFK, but I'm not going to go storm Langley to act out on this belief. They believe these conspiracy theories that are so extreme, like a lot of the people in the Capitol mob believe in the QAnon conspiracy theory that the Democratic Party is led by this group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. And if they truly believe that, then of course they're motivated to violence, because you have to stop these evil people from killing the children or to stop them from stealing the election.
Yeah. Ultimately, how do you think this is going to shape how people vote with midterm elections, you know, this year, just months away?
Well, I mean, I always start with a warning that I'm a historian, so I study the past. So whenever anybody asks me to predict the future, I say I'm not necessarily very good at that. But I would say that, first of all, I think a lot depends on what we learn from the January 6th committee, that they are coming out. They will have public hearings. They will have reports. They will have evidence. And so a lot depends on what they find out about President Trump's role in inspiring the protests. And a lot also depends on how people then respond to that evidence. Are they going to take it on board? Is it going to change their vote? At a minimum, I think January 6th is going to lead to further polarization of the electorate, because there are apparently, according to polls, 2/3 of Republicans who believe that the election was stolen, the 2020 election. And so they're presumably going to be very motivated to support their candidates. On the other side, a lot of Democrats think that this 2022, 2024 are going to be like these existential elections, where if they don't win them, they might not have another election. So I think we're going to see a lot of motivated voters, And it remains to be seen whether what we learn about January 6th is going to change how people vote.
Professor Olmsted, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Catherine Olmsted is a professor of U.S. history at UC Davis, sharing the historical context and potential consequences of January 6th. Professor Olmsted and her colleagues are hosting the U.S. Capitol insurrection 1 year later this afternoon, which is open to the public. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.